The fire alarm had not been silenced. The men used hand signals. Every cupboard or broom closet had to be treated as a hot zone. Many doors were locked, so they blasted them open with rifle fire. Kids trapped in classrooms heard gunfire steadily approaching. Death appeared imminent. Parents, reporters, and even cops outside heard the shots and came to similar conclusions. One room at a time, the team worked methodically toward the killers. It would take 3 hours to reach their bodies. On the west side, where the killers were active, a fire department team staged a riskier operation. Half a dozen bodies remained on or near the lawn outside the cafeteria. Several showed signs of life. Anne-Marie, Lance, and Sean had been bleeding for 40 minutes. Deputies along the perimeter moved in closer to provide cover while three paramedics and an EMT rushed in. Eric appeared in the second-floor library window and fired on them. Two deputies shot back. Others laid down suppressive fire. The paramedics got three students out. Danny was pronounced dead and left behind. Eric disappeared. Lieutenant Manwaring's half of the SWAT team had inched around outside the building using the fire truck for cover. They arrived at the opposite side half an hour later. They rescued Richard Castaldo from the lawn around 12:35, an hour and a quarter after he was shot. They made another approach to retrieve Rachel Scott. They brought her back as far as the fire truck. Then they determined she was dead and aborted. They laid her there on the ground. Finally, they went for Danny Rohrbaugh, unaware of the prior finding. They left him on the sidewalk. At 1:15, a second SWAT team charged the building from the senior lot, smashed a window in the teacher's lounge, and vaulted in. The officers quickly entered the adjacent cafeteria, but found it nearly deserted. Food was left half-eaten on the tables. Books, backpacks, and assorted garbage floated about the room, which had been flooded by the sprinkler system. Water was 3 to 4 inches high and rising. A fire had blackened ceiling tiles and melted down some chairs. They did not notice the duffel bags held down by the weight of the bombs. One bag had burned away. The propane tank sat exposed, mostly above water, but it blended into the debris. Signs of panic were everywhere, but no injuries, no bodies, no blood. There were lots of healthy people. The team was shocked to discover dozens of terrified students and staff. They were crouched in storage closets up above the ceiling tiles or plainly visible under cafeteria tables. One teacher had climbed into the ceiling and tried to crawl clear through the ductwork out to safety to warn police, but had fallen through and required medical care. Two men were shivering in the freezer, so cold they could barely lift their arms. The SWAT team searched them and shuttled them out the window they came in. At first, that was easy, but the farther they moved, the more officers they had to leave behind to secure the route. They brought in more manpower to assist. Overhead, circling steadily, chopper blades beat out a steady thuk, 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 thuk. Robin Anderson watched it all from the parking lot. She had headed to Dairy Queen with her friends, zipped through the drive-thru, and circled back to school. There were a whole lot of cops when they got back. Officers were assembling the perimeter, but the entrance to the senior lot was still open. Robin pulled into her space. A cop strode up with his gun drawn. "Stay where you are," he warned. It was already too late to back out. Robin and her friends would wait in her car for 2.5 hours. Robin ducked when she saw Eric appear in the library window. She couldn't tell it was him. She was too far back. All she could make out was a guy in a white T-shirt firing a rifle in her general direction. "Who would do something like this?" Robin asked her girlfriends. "Who would be this retarded?" Robin looked over to her friends' spaces. Eric, Dylan, and Zach had assigned spots, 3 in a row. Zach's car was there. Eric's and Dylan's were missing. Nate Dykeman was terrified of who might be responsible. He had called most of his close friends, but had held off on Eric and Dylan. He had been hoping to hear from them, hoping, but not really expecting. Dylan would break his heart. They had been tight for years. Nate spent a lot of time at his house, and Tom and Sue Klebold had looked after him. Nate had a lot of trouble at home, and the Klebolds had been like a second mom and dad. Dylan did not call. Around noon, Nate dialed his house. Tom Klebold would be home. He worked from there. Hopefully, Dylan was with him. Tom picked up. No, Dylan was not there. He's in school, Tom said. Actually, no, he isn't, Nate said. Dylan had not been in class, and Nate didn't want to worry Tom, but there had been a shooting. There had been descriptions. The gunmen were in trench coats. Nate knew several kids with trench coats. He was trying to account for all of them. He hated breaking the news, but he had to say it. He thought Dylan was involved. Tom went up to Dylan's room, checked his closet for the coat. Oh, my God, he said. It's not here. Tom was shocked, Nate said later. I thought he was going to, drop the phone. He just could not believe that this could possibly be happening, and his son was involved. Please keep me informed, Tom told him, whatever you hear. Tom got off the phone. He turned on the TV. It was everywhere. He called Sue. She came home. Tom called their older son. He and Sue had kicked Byron out for using drugs. They would not tolerate that behavior. But this was too important. Tom apparently withheld his fears about Dylan. Byron told coworkers he was terrified his brother was trapped. He was also worried about younger friends still in school. I've got to see if everybody's okay, he said. Lots of Byron's workmates were connected to the school. They all headed home. Tom Klebold called 911 to warn them his son might be involved. He also called a lawyer. The televised version of the disaster was running 30 minutes to an hour behind the cops' view. Anchors dutifully repeated the perimeter concept. The cops had sealed off the perimeter. But what were all those troops doing exactly? Up there, everyone seemed to be about. Anchors started wondering aloud. Luckily, no one seemed to be seriously injured. Around 12:30, the story took its first grisly turn. Local TV reporters gained access to the triage areas. It was awful. So much blood, it was hard to identify the injuries. Lots of kids had been loaded into ambulances. Area hospitals were all on alert. Half a dozen news choppers circled, but they withheld most of their footage. For a few minutes, stations had broadcast live from the air, but the sheriff's team had demanded they stop. Every room in Columbine was equipped with a television. The gunmen might well be watching. Cameras would home in on the very images most useful to the killers, SWAT maneuvers and wounded kids awaiting rescue. TV stations also held back news of fatalities. Their chopper crews had seen paramedics examine Danny and leave him behind. The public remained unaware. The stations also caught glimpses of a disturbing scene playing out in a second-story classroom in another wing of the building, far from the library, in Science Room 3. It was hard to make out exactly what was going on in there, but there was a lot of activity and one disturbing clue. Someone had dragged a large white marker board to the window with a message in huge block letters. The first character looked a lot like a capital I, but turned out to be a numeral. One, bleeding to death.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 3. Columbine, by Dave Cullen, continued. Disc 3.
14. Hostage Standoff. Around 1 p.m., word filtered out to reporters that kids were trapped in the building. The situation had escalated into a hostage standoff. Publicly, the nature of the attack changed. No telling what the assailants might try. Where were they? The captives seemed to be held in the commons, but reports conflicted. Word of the ambulance scenes and the hostage standoff traveled quickly to Leewood in the public library. Parents grew tenser, but they worked together, exchanging information and passing around cell phones. It was tough to get a signal. Cell phones were not ubiquitous in 1999, yet everyone in this affluent community seemed to have one. They pounded at them furiously, grilling neighbors, updating relatives, leaving messages for their children on every conceivable answering machine. Some would hit redial absentmindedly as they swapped information face to face, buzzing their own homes, praying that the machine wouldn't pick up this time. Misty kept calling Brad, still no word on Chris or Cassie. Then a fresh story zipped through the pack. 20 students, or 30, or 40, were still inside the school. They were not hostages. They were hiding, barricaded in the choir room with equipment piled high against the door. The parents gasped. Was that good news or bad? Dozens more students were in danger, but dozens more confirmed alive, if it was true. A lot of wild rumors had already come and gone. At least 200 to 300 students were hiding in the school, in classrooms and utility closets, under tables and desks. Some had rigged up protection. Others were right out in the open. Everyone was afraid to move. A great number whispered cautiously into cell phones. Many clustered around classroom TVs. They heard banging and crashing and the deafening screech of the fire alarm. CNN carried a live call between a local anchor and a student alone under a desk. What was he hearing? "The same thing as you," the student said. "I've got a little TV, and I'm watching you guys right now." For 4 hours, rumors, confirmations, and embellishments bounced in and out. The cops were livid. Reporters had no idea hundreds of kids were trapped inside and no concept of the echo chamber in full bloom. The cops knew. The detective force was assembling teams to interview every survivor, and they knew hundreds of their best witnesses were still inside, getting compromised by the minute. But the cops had no means to stop it. This was the first major hostage standoff of the cell phone age, and they had never seen anything like it. At the moment, they were more concerned with information passing to the shooters. Sometimes the kids' revelations scared reporters. On live TV, a boy described sounds he took to be the gunman. "I hear stuff being thrown around," he said. "I am staying underneath this desk. I don't know if they know I'm up here. I am just staying upstairs for right now, and I just hope they don't know..." The anchorwoman interrupted. "Don't tell us where you are." The boy described more commotion. "There's a little bunch of people crying outside. I can hear them downstairs." Something crashed. "Whoa!" The anchor gasped. "What was that?" "I don't know." The anchor's had enough. Her partner told them to hang up, keep quiet, and try to reach 911. "Keep trying to call them, okay?" The cops pleaded with the TV stations to stop. "Please ask the hostages to quit calling the media," they said. "Tell them to turn off the televisions." The stations aired the requests and continued broadcasting the calls. "If you're watching, kids, turn the TV off," one anchor implored, "or down at least." Much of the country was watching the standoff unfold. None of the earlier school shootings had been televised. Few American tragedies had. The Columbine situation played out slowly, with the cameras rolling. Or at least it appeared that way. The cameras offered the illusion we were witnessing the event, but the cameras had arrived too late. Eric and Dylan had retreated inside after 5 minutes. The cameras missed the outside murders and could not follow Eric and Dylan inside. The fundamental experience for most of America was almost witnessing mass murder. It was the panic and frustration of not knowing, the mounting terror of horror withheld, just out of view. We would learn the truth about Columbine, but we would not learn it today. We saw fragments. What the cameras showed us was misleading. An army of police held at bay suggested an equivalent force inside. Hysterical witnesses corroborated that image, describing wildly different assaults. Killers seemed to be everywhere. Cell phone callers confirmed the killers remained active. They provided unimpeachable evidence of gunfire from inside the attack zone. The data was correct. The conclusions were wrong. SWAT teams were on the move. The narrative unfolding on television looked nothing like the killer's plan. It looked only moderately like what was actually occurring. It would take months for investigators to piece together what had gone on inside. Motive would take longer to unravel. It would be years before the detective team would explain why. The public couldn't wait that long. The media was not about to. They speculated. 15. First Assumption. An investigative team had assembled before noon. Kate Batten was named lead investigator. Batten already knew who her primary suspects were. Most of the students were perplexed about who was attacking them, but quite a few had recognized the gunman. Two names had been repeated over and over. Batten quickly compiled dossiers on Eric and Dylan in the command post trailer in Clement Park. She dispatched teams to secure their homes. Detectives arrived at the Harris place at 1:15, just as the third SWAT team burst into the Columbine teacher's lounge. Eric's parents had gotten word and were already home. The cops found them uncooperative. They tried to refuse entrance. The cops insisted. Kathy Harris got scared when they headed for the basement. "I don't want you going down there," she said. They said they were securing the residence and removing everyone. Wayne said he doubted Eric was involved, but would help if there was an active situation. Kathy's twin sister was with her. Wayne and Kathy were concerned about the repercussions, she explained. Parents of the victims might retaliate. The cops smelled gas. They had the utility company shut off power, then resumed the search. In Eric's room, they found a sawed-off shotgun barrel on a bookshelf, unspent ammunition on the bed, fingertips cut off gloves on the floor, and fireworks and bomb materials on the desk, the dresser, the windowsill, and the wall, among other places. Elsewhere, they discovered a page from the anarchist cookbook, packaging for a new gas can, and scattered glass shards on a slab in the backyard. An evidence specialist arrived that night and spent 4 hours shooting 7 rolls of film. He left at 1 a.m. The Klebolds were much more forthcoming. A police report described Tom as very communicative. He gave a full account of Dylan's past and laid out all his friendships. Dylan had been in good spirits, Tom said. Sue described him as extremely happy. Tom was anti-gun, and Dylan agreed with him on that. They wouldn't find any guns or explosives in the house. That was for sure, Tom said. The cops did find pipe bombs. Tom was shocked. Dylan was fine, he insisted. He and Dylan were close. He would have known it if anything was up. The first FBI agent on the scene at Columbine was Supervisory Special Agent Duane Fuselier. He had shaken the Cajun accent on everything but his name. Fuselier, he said. Everyone got it wrong. He was a veteran agent, a clinical psychologist, a terrorism expert, and one of the leading hostage negotiators in the country. None of that led Dr. Fuselier to Columbine High. His wife had called. Their son was in the school. Fuselier got the call in the cafeteria of Denver's Rogers Federal Building, a downtown high-rise 30 minutes away. He was sipping a bowl of bland soup, low salt, for his hypertension. The bowl stayed on the table. When he got to his Dodge Intrepid, Fuselier swiped his arm under the seat, groping for the portable police light. He hadn't pulled it out in years. Fuselier headed toward the foothills. He would offer his services as a hostage negotiator, or anything else they might need. He wasn't sure how his offer would be received. Cops in crisis tend to be thrilled to have a trained negotiator, but wary of the feds. Hardly anyone likes the FBI. Fuselier didn't blame them. Federal agents generally have a high opinion of themselves. Few try to conceal it. Fuselier didn't look like a fed or sound the part. He was a shrink turned hostage negotiator turned detective with an abridged version of the complete works of Shakespeare in the back seat of his car. He didn't talk past the local cops, roll his eyes, or humor them. There was no swagger in his shoulders or his speech. He could be a little stoic. Hugging his sons felt awkward, but he would reach out to embrace survivors when they needed it. Smiling came easy. His jokes were frequently at his own expense. He genuinely liked local cops and appreciated what they had to offer. They liked him. A stint on the Domestic Terrorism Task Force for the region proved fortuitous. It was a joint operation between local agencies and the FBI. Fuselier led the unit, and a senior Jeffco detective worked on his team. The detective was one of Fuselier's first calls. He was relieved to hear that Duane was on his way and offered to introduce him to the commanders on arrival. The detective brought Fusilier up to speed before he arrived at the school. There were reports of 6 or 8 gunmen in black masks and military gear shooting everyone. He assumed it was a terrorist attack. It took a certain voice to talk down a gunman. Agent Fusilier was always gentle and reassuring. No matter how erratic the subject's behavior, Fusilier always responded calmly. He exuded tranquility, offered a way out. He trained negotiators to read a subject quickly, to size up his primary motivations. Was the gunman driven by anger, fear, or resentment? Was he on a power trip? Was the assault meant to feed his ego? Or was he caught up in events beyond his control? Getting the gun down was primarily a matter of listening. The first thing Fusilier taught negotiators was to classify the situation as hostage or non-hostage. To laymen, humans at gunpoint equaled hostages. Not so. An FBI field manual citing Fusilier's research spelled out the crucial distinction. Hostages are a means to fulfill demands. The primary goal is not to harm the hostages, the manual said. In fact, hostage takers realize that only through keeping the hostages alive can they hope to achieve their goals. They act rationally. Non-hostage gunmen do not. The humans mean nothing to them. These individuals act in an emotional, senseless, and often self-destructive way. They typically issue no demands. What they want is what they already have, the victim. The potential for homicide followed by suicide in many of these cases is very high. Jeffco officials had labeled Columbine a hostage standoff. Every media outlet was reporting it that way. Dr. Fusilier considered the chances of that remote. What he was driving toward was much worse. To the FBI, the non-hostage distinction is critical. The Bureau recommends radically different strategies in those cases, essentially the opposite approach. With hostages, negotiators remain highly visible, make the gunmen work for everything, and firmly establish that the police are in control. In non-hostage situations, they keep a low profile, give a little without getting in return, for example, offering cigarettes to build rapport, and avoid even a slight implication that anyone but the gunman is in control. The goal with hostages is to gradually lower expectations. In non-hostage crises, it's to lower emotions. One of the first things Fusilier did when he arrived was organize a negotiation team. He found local officers he had trained, and fellow FBI negotiators responded as well. A neighboring county loaned them a section of its mobile command post, already on scene. The 911 operators were instructed to put through to the team all calls from kids inside the building. Anything they could learn about the gunman might be useful. They passed on logistical information they gathered to the tactical teams. The team was confident they could talk the gunman down. All they needed was someone to speak to. Fusilier shuttled between the negotiations center and the Jeffco command post, coordinating the federal response. When things calmed down momentarily, Fusilier pitched in questioning students who had just escaped the school. He walked over to the triage unit and flipped through the logs. They had evaluated hundreds of kids. He scanned for kids he knew from the neighborhood or the boys' soccer teams. Everyone he recognized said, evaluated and released. He called their parents as soon as he got a break. His son's name never came up. Agent Fusilier was grateful to have his hands full. "I had work to do," he said later. "I compartmentalized. Focusing on that kept me from wondering about Brian." Mimi checked in regularly, so Duane didn't have to. She had gotten to Leewood, and she had seen a lot of kids. No one had spotted Brian. No one had heard a word. An attack of this magnitude suggested a large conspiracy. Everyone, including detectives, assumed a substantial number were involved. The first break in the presumed conspiracy seemed to come early. The killer's good friend, Chris Morris, reported himself to 911. He had seen the news on TV while he was home playing Nintendo with another friend. At first, he was worried about his girlfriend, and his Nintendo buddy's dad was a science teacher in the building. The two boys hopped in the car and raced around, trying to find Chris's girlfriend. They kept running into police barricades and collecting scraps of information along the way. When he heard about the trench coats, Chris got scared. He knew Eric and Dylan had guns. He knew they had been messing with pipe bombs. For this? Chris called 911. He got disconnected. It took a few tries, but he told his story, and the dispatcher sent a patrol car by the house. The cops questioned him briefly, then decided to drive him out to the main team in Clement Park. There was a lot of confusion. Who was this kid? Chris Harris? A detective asked. Pretty soon he was surrounded by detectives. Cameramen noticed. TV crews came running. Chris looked the part. Squishy features, nerdy, and overwhelmed. He had rosy cheeks, wire-rimmed glasses, and mussy light brown hair just past his ears. The cops cuffed him fast and got him into the back of a patrol car. By now, many of the killer's buddies suspected them. It was a scary time to be Eric's or Dylan's friend. From the outset, before they even had names or identities for the gunman, TV reporters depicted the boys as a single entity. Were they loners? Reporters kept asking witnesses. Were they outcasts? Always they, and always the attributes fitting the school shooter profile, itself a myth. The witnesses nearly always concurred. Few knew the killers, but they did not volunteer that information, and they were not asked. Yeah, outcasts. I heard they were. Fusilier arrived at Columbine with one assumption. Multiple gunmen demanded multiple tactics. Fusilier couldn't afford to think of his adversaries as a unit. Strategies likely to disarm one shooter could infuriate the other. Mass murderers tended to work alone, but when they did pair up, they rarely chose their mirror image. Fusilier knew he was much more likely to find a pair of opposites holed up in that building. It was entirely possible that there was no single why, and much more likely that he would unravel one motive for Eric, another for Dylan. Reporters quickly keyed on the darker force behind the attack. This spooky trench coat mafia, it grew more bizarre by the minute. In the first 2 hours, witnesses on CNN described the TCM as goths, gays, outcasts, and a street gang. A lot of the time, they'll, like, wear makeup and paint their nails and stuff, a Columbine senior said. They're kind of, I don't know, like goth, sort of, like, and they're, like, associated with death and violence a lot. None of that would prove to be true. That student did not, in fact, know the people he was describing. But the story grew. 16. The Boy in the Window. Danny Rohrbaugh had been second to die. As Eric was taking aim at him on the sidewalk, Danny's stepsister was in the building, headed toward him. Nicole Patron had changed into her gym uniform while the bombs were being laid. It was a beautiful day, and her class was going outside to play softball. Just as Eric finished shooting at Deputy Gardner, the lead girls in Nicole's class turned the corner toward them. Mr. D arrived in the hallway at the same moment, at the opposite end from the killers. He had just been alerted to the shooting and had come running to investigate. The girls had not been warned. Mr. D spotted Dylan and Eric coming in the west doors and the girls blundering into their path. They were laughing and giggling and getting ready to walk right into it, he said. The killers fired. Bullets soared past the girls. The trophy case just behind Mr. D shattered. I assumed I was a dead man, he said. He ran straight into the gunfire, screaming at the girls to turn back. He herded them down a side hallway that dead-ended at the gym. It was locked. Mr. D had the key on a chain in his pocket, latched to dozens just like it. He had no idea what it looked like. I'm thinking, he's coming around the corner and we're trapped, DeAngelis said. If I don't get these doors open, we are trapped. A movie image zipped through his mind. A Nazi concentration camp with a guard shooting escapees in the back. We're just going to get mowed down as he comes around the corner, he thought. He reached in and grabbed the random key. It fit. He ushered the girls into the gym and scouted around for a hiding place. They could hear bombs and gunfire, and he could only imagine the hell going on outside. He spotted an inconspicuous door on the far wall. There was a storage room behind it, with cages piled with gym equipment. He unlocked the door and led them in. "You're going to be fine," he told them. "I'm not going to let anything happen to you, but I need to get us out of here. I'm going to shut the door behind me. You don't open that door for anyone." Then he had an idea. Why didn't they come up with a code word? "Orange," someone suggested. "No, rebels," another girl said. "No." A few started quarreling about it. Mr. D couldn't believe it. He burst out laughing. Girls started giggling. That broke the tension for a moment. He locked them in the storeroom, crossed the gym, creaked open the outside door, and poked his head out. "I saw other kids coming out, and teachers," he said. "Then a Jeffco sheriff. His car came over that embankment, flying, and I told some of the teachers, 'I have to go back in there. There are kids in there.' So I told the police officer after he got out, and I explained. He said, 'You go in.' Mr. D brought Nicole's class back out to the same spot with the same cop, but by now he'd realized there were hundreds more still inside. 'I'm going,' he began, but a deputy cut him off. 'No one's going back in.' So Mr. D led the class across a field, over a series of minor obstacles. He stopped at a chain-link fence to boost them over. Other girls assisted from the far side. 'Let's go, girls,' he said. 'Over the fence.' When the last girl was over, they ran across the field until they felt safe. Mr. D found the command post and drew diagrams of the hallways for the SWAT teams. He also described what he had seen. He remembered a guy with a baseball cap turned backward. "They kept saying these guys were in trench coats," Mr. D recalled later. "And I kept saying, 'These guys were not in trench coats. He had a baseball cap turned backwards.'" Eventually, Mr. D headed to Leawood to be with the kids. He met his wife there, his brother, and a close friend. Tears streamed down everyone's cheeks, except Frank's. That was odd. Frank had always been the emotional one, but the first symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, was already taking hold. He felt nothing. "I was like a zombie," he said later. John and Kathy Ireland knew Patrick had a lunch, but he always ate out. John went looking for Patrick's car. He knew Patrick's spot. If the car was gone, his boy was safe. A deputy stopped him at the perimeter. "Please," John begged. He promised not to walk as far as the school. "If I can just get to the parking lot." Pleading was useless. John knew the neighborhood, so he tried another approach. That one was blocked, too. He headed back to Leawood. Kids kept pouring in there. Mostly the auditorium was filled with parents seeking kids, but there were also kids without parents. John saw several in tears. He chatted with them, and they perked up. John and Kathy were happy to see kids find their parents, but every reunion raised the odds their boy was in trouble. Somebody's kids were in those ambulances. John and Kathy refused to indulge in negative thoughts. "I couldn't go to the place that Pat would have been hurt," Kathy said later. "I absolutely felt confident that he was going to be okay. At least I wasn't going to speculate or waste energy on that. I just needed to find him." John found lots of Patrick's friends, but nobody had seen him. Who was he with? Why hadn't they called? Patrick had gone to the library to finish his stats homework. Four friends had joined him. None of them had called the Irelands because every one of them had been shot. Agent Dwayne Fuselier was also having no luck locating his son. Mimi had given up on the public library and had run over to Leawood. There were many more kids there, but none had seen Brian. Dwayne had access to a growing army of law enforcement, but it didn't do him a lick of good. Cops kept an ear out for word of Brian, but none came. Fuselier also had the advantage of knowing a great number of kids were alive and well in the building. He had spoken to many personally and continued picking their brains about the killers. He was one of the few parents aware of the full danger. Two bodies had been lying outside the cafeteria for hours. He didn't know they were Danny Rohrbaugh and Rachel Scott, but he knew they had not been moving, and then he heard the dispatch announcements indicating they were dead. Others describe the one bleeding to death sign in Science Room 3. Mimi monitored the stage at Leewood, where talk of death and murder were verboten. She scoured the sign-in sheets and worked the crowd. Dwayne checked in every 15 minutes by cell, but did not mention the murders. She did not inquire. For 90 minutes of chaos, the gunmen seemed to be all over the school simultaneously. Then it quieted down. The killer still appeared to be roaming, firing at will, but the gunfire was sporadic now, and no one was staggering out wounded. The injured had reached the hospitals. It had taken an hour to get most of them out of the building, through the triage center, and into ambulances. Between 1 and 2:30 p.m., the injury count fluctuated between 8 and 18, depending upon which station you were watching. The numbers varied, but kept rising. A sheriff's spokesman announced that SWAT teams had spotted more students trapped in the building, lying on the floor, apparently injured. Suddenly, at 1:44 p.m., the cops finally nabbed someone. "We've got three students with their hands up with two police cars around them," a reporter told CNN. "Their hands are up." The cops detained them at gunpoint. Word spread quickly to the library. "They surrendered," a woman screamed. "It's over." They celebrated there briefly. The truth trickled back slowly. Just before 2:30, an officer riding along in a news chopper spotted somebody moving inside the library. He was just inside the blown-out windows, covered in blood, and behaving curiously, sagging against the frame, clearing away shards of glass. He was going to jump. The officer radioed a SWAT team. They read the Loomis armored truck and raced toward the building. "Hang on, kid," one of them called. "We're coming to get you." Patrick Ireland was confused. He heard someone yell, but couldn't see anyone or figure out where the voices were coming from. He felt dizzy. His vision was blurry, and one big section was blank. He was unaware that blood was streaming down into his eyes. The shouting inside his head was more important. "Get out! Get out!" But the muddled outside yelling had caught his attention. Why were they talking so slowly? Everything was deep and mumbly, like his head was underwater. Where was he? Not sure. Something had happened. Something horrible. Shot? "Get out! Get out!" Hours earlier, Patrick Ireland had taken refuge under the table with his friends. Mackay and Dan were down there, and a girl he didn't know. Corey and Austin had gone to investigate and ended up somewhere unknown. Patrick put his head down and closed his eyes. The shooting was barely underway in the library when he heard Mackay moan. Patrick opened his eyes. Mackay's knee was bleeding. Patrick leaned over to administer pressure. The top of his head poked over the edge of the tabletop. Dylan saw him and fired the shotgun again. Patrick went blank. Patrick's skull had stopped several buckshot fragments. Other debris lodged in his scalp as well, probably wood splinters torn from the tabletop in the blast. One pellet got through. It burrowed 6 inches through spongy brain matter, entering through the scalp just above his hairline on the left, and lodging near the middle rear. Bits of his optical center were missing. Most of his language capacity was wiped out. He regained consciousness, but words were hard to form and different to interpret as well. Pathways for all sorts of functions had been severed. Perception was impeded, so he couldn't tell when he was speaking gibberish or jumbling incoming sounds. The left brain controls the right side of the body, and the pellet cut through that connection. Patrick was paralyzed on the right side. He had been shot in the right foot. It was broken and bleeding. He didn't even know. He felt nothing on that side. Patrick drifted in and out. He was semi-conscious when the killers left the room. All the kids were running for the back exit. Mackay and Dan tried to get his attention. He returned a blank stare. "Come on, man," one of them said. "Let's go." It didn't register. They tried to drag him, but both had been shot in the legs and Patrick was limp. They got nowhere. The killers could return any moment. Eventually, they gave up and fled. Sometime later, Patrick woke up on the floor again. "Get out!" He tried to get out. Half his body refused. He couldn't stand. He couldn't even crawl right. He reached with his left hand, gripped something, and dragged himself forward. His useless side trailed behind. He made a little progress, and his brain gave out. He came to repeatedly and began again. No one knows how many times. A bloody trail revealed his convoluted path. He started less than 2 table lengths from the windows, but he headed off in the wrong direction. Then he hit obstacles, bodies, table legs, and chairs. Some he pushed away, others had to be maneuvered around. He kept heading for the light. If he could just make it to the windows, maybe someone would see him. If he had to, maybe he would jump. It took 3 hours to get there. He found an easy chair beside the opening. It was sturdy enough not to tip and might provide cover if the killers returned. He wedged his back against the short wall and worked himself upward, then grabbed hold of the chair for a final push. He propped himself against the girder between 2 large panes and rested a while to recover his strength. Then he flipped around. He had one more task before he took the plunge. The problem was that Patrick couldn't jump. There was a waist-high window ledge to get over. The best he could do was lean forward and tumble over it headfirst onto the sidewalk. His gut would bear down on the sill as he rolled over it. It was a jagged mess. The gun blasts had blown out most of the glass, but left shards clinging around the frame. Patrick stood on one leg, braced his shoulder against the girder, and picked away the chunks with the same hand. He was meticulous. He didn't want to get hurt. That's when he heard the murky voices. "Stay there! We're going to get you!" The armored truck pulled up beneath the window. A squadron of SWAT officers leapt out. Nearby, teams provided cover from either side. One group took aim from behind a fire truck. Snipers sprawled on rooftops, trained their scopes from farther back. If this rescue mission was fired upon, they'd be ready. Patrick wasn't waiting. He thought he was. He remembers them calling, "Okay, it's safe. Go ahead and jump. We'll catch you." The rescue team recalls it differently, and the video shows them scrambling into place. Patrick collapsed forward. The ledge caught him at the waist, and he folded in half, head dangling toward the ground. The SWAT team wasn't ready, but Patrick was frantic and didn't understand. He wiggled forward, but couldn't get much traction from the inside because his feet were already up off the floor. A SWAT officer clambered up the side of the truck and threw his weapon to the ground. Another followed close behind him. As the first man hit the truck roof, Patrick kicked his good leg up toward the ceiling and reached down for the sidewalk with his arms. That nearly did it. One more thrust, and he would be free. The officers lunged toward him, and each man caught one of his hands. Patrick kicked again, completely vertical, and his hips pulled away from the frame. The officers clenched, and his hands barely moved. The rest of his body spun around like a gymnast, gripping the high bar until he whacked into the side of the truck. The officers kept hold and eased him down onto the hood. He tried to break away, still desperate to flee. They lowered him down to other officers, but he kicked hard, and his legs slammed against the ground. They pulled him upright, and he tried to climb into the front seat. The SWAT team was confused. What was he trying to do? They assumed he understood he was the patient. He did not. He had to get out of there. Here was a truck. He was ready to go. They got him to a triage site, and then straight into an ambulance. On the drive to St. Anthony Central Hospital, paramedics cut off Patrick's bloody clothes, everything but his undershorts. They removed his gold necklace with the water ski pendant. He had $6 in his wallet. He was not wearing shoes. They confirmed gunshot wounds to his left forehead and his right foot, as well as a number of superficial wounds about his head. His elbow was lacerated. As they worked, they tested Patrick's mental acuity and tried to keep him conscious. "Do you know where you are? Your name? Your birthday?" Patrick could answer those questions slowly, laboriously. The answers were easy, but he struggled to form them into words. Most of his brain tissue was intact. Sections could function in isolation, but the connecting circuitry was confused. Patrick's brain was less successful forming new memories. He knew he had been shot by a man in black with a long gun. That was true. The masks he described on the killer's faces were not. He insisted he had been shot at a hospital in the emergency room. Speech was a problem. Only one side of his mouth moved, and his brain was inconsistent in retrieving information. Sometimes it got stuck. He gave them all 10 digits of his phone number, but his first name was nearly impossible. He could not form that second syllable. It sounded like a droning stream of nonsense. And then the second syllable spat out suddenly, clear and distinctive. Rick. Great. Rick Ireland. That caused considerable confusion later. Just before Patrick's rescue, President Clinton addressed the nation. He asked all Americans to pray for students and teachers in that school. As CNN cut back from the White House, an anchor spotted Patrick. "Look, there's a bloody student right there in the window," she gasped. It played out live on television. Patrick's eighth-grade sister Maggie watched. He was so bloody, she didn't recognize him. Viewers were stunned, but it didn't make much of an impression at the rendezvous points. News of a kid falling out the window never reached most parents, including John and Kathy. They might have gone on searching for hours if Kathy hadn't asked a neighbor to run by the house to check the answering machine. The neighbor found endless messages from Kathy checking for Patrick, plus a recent one from St. Anthony's. "We have your son. Please call." Kathy was conflicted. "My son's alive. My son is hurt." It was scary, Kathy said later, but I was relieved to have something to deal with. She felt much better once she got a nurse on the phone. It was a head wound, but Patrick was awake and alert. He had provided his name and phone number. Oh, good, it was just a graze, Kathy thought. "I just went straight to the assumption that it was just the scalp," she said later. "If he was able to talk, then it was just the scalp." John felt grave danger, no relief. "I just figured anybody shot in the head, it can't be good," he said. John drove the couple to the hospital. He was a computer programmer who prided himself on his navigational skill. He was too upset to find the hospital. He knew exactly how to get to St. Anthony's, he said. "And I'm driving down Wadsworth, and I can't remember where the hell it is." They sat side by side, presuming they shared the same basic assumptions. It was 7 years before they discovered that they arrived at St. Anthony's in completely different mindsets. John was racked with guilt. "There should have been something I was able to do to protect him," he said. John knew it was irrational, but years later, it still haunted him. Kathy focused on the present. How could she help Patrick now? But no one even knew exactly what was wrong. Staff kept coming in to check on them, filling them in on the surgery, what to expect in Patrick and themselves. Dead brain cells do not regenerate, but the brain can sometimes work around them, they were told. No one really understands how the brain reroutes its neural pathways, so there's no procedure to assist it. A projectile to the brain tends to cause two sets of damage. First, it rips away tissue that can never be restored. One path might cause blindness, another, logical impairment. But the secondary impact can be just as bad, or worse. The brain is saturated with blood, so gunshots tend to unleash a flood. As fluid builds, oxygen is depleted, and the pool cuts off fresh supplies. Brain tissue is choked off by the very cells designed to nourish it. Patrick's doctors feared that as he'd lain on the library floor, his brain had been drowning in its own blood. Patrick Ireland had brain damage, that was a fact. His symptoms indicated severe impairment. The only question was whether those functions could return. The surgery was scheduled to take about an hour, but lasted more than 3. It was after 7 p.m. when the surgeon came out to advise John and Kathy of the results. He had cleared out buckshot fragments and debris from the surface. One pellet had penetrated Patrick's skull. It was far too perilous to dig out. That lead would be in him for life. It was hard to tell how much damage the pellet had wreaked. Swelling was the main indicator. It looked bad. As one SWAT team rescued Patrick Ireland, another squad reached the choir room. The rumor was true. 60 students were barricaded inside. A few minutes later, 60 more were discovered in the science area. SWAT teams led them through the hallways, down the stairs, and across the commons. At 2:47, 3.5 hours into the siege, the first of those kids burst out the cafeteria doors. News choppers homed in on them instantly. The anchors and the TV audience were perplexed. Where were these kids coming from? More followed, single file in quick succession, running down the hillside as fast as they could, with their hands on the backs of their heads, elbows splayed. They kept coming and coming, dozens of them, tracing the same winding path, first away from the school, then back toward a windowless corner surrounded by squad cars and ambulances. They huddled there for several minutes, sobbing, waiting, clinging to one another. Police officers patted them down and then hugged them. Eventually, cops packed groups of 3 to 5 kids into squad cars and shuttled them to the triage area a few blocks south. The kids had to run right past 2 bodies on the way out, so at some point, an officer moved Rachel farther away. The SWAT team reached the 1 bleeding to death sign on the same sweep through the science area that freed all those kids. The sign was still against the window. The carpet in Science Room 3 was soaked in blood. The teacher was alive, barely. 17. The Sheriff. The Columbine crisis was never a hostage standoff. Eric and Dylan had no intentions of making demands. SWAT teams searched the building for over 3 hours, but the killers were lying dead the entire time. They had committed suicide in the library at 12:08, 49 minutes after beginning the attack. The killing and the terror had been real. The standoff had not. The SWAT teams discovered the truth around 3:15. They peered into the library and saw bodies scattered around the floor. No sign of movement. They cleared the entrance and prepared to enter. They took paramedic Troy Lamon in with them. The SWAT team warned Lamon to be cautious. Touch as little as possible, they said. Anything could be booby-trapped. Be especially suspicious of backpacks. It was horrible. The room was a shambles. Blood spattered the furniture and enormous pools soaked into the carpet. The tabletops were oddly undisturbed. Books open, calculus problems underway, a college application half completed. A lifeless boy still held a pencil. Another had collapsed beside a PC, which was still running, undisturbed. Lamon was tasked with determining whether anyone was alive. It didn't look like it. Most of the kids had been dead for nearly 4 hours, and it was obvious by sight. If I couldn't get a look at somebody, at their face, to see if they were still alive, I tried to kind of touch them, Lamon said. 12 were cold. 1 was not. Lamon touched a girl, felt the warmth, and rolled her over to get a look at her face. Her eyes were open, tears trickling out. Lisa Krutz was carried down the stairs and rushed to Denver Health Medical Center. A gun blast had shattered her left shoulder. One hand and both arms were also injured. She had lost a lot of blood. She survived. Most of the bodies lay under tables. The victims had been attempting to hide. 2 bodies were different. They lay out in the open, weapons by their sides. Suicides, clearly. The SWAT team had descriptions of Eric and Dylan. These 2 looked like a match. It was over. The team discovered 4 women hiding in back rooms attached to the library. Patty Nielsen, the art teacher from the 911 call, had crept into a cupboard in the break room. She had squatted in the cupboard for 3 more hours, knees aching, unaware the danger had passed. 3 other faculty hid farther back. An officer instructed one to put her hand on his shoulder and follow him out, staring directly at his helmet to minimize exposure to the horror. It had been over how long? No one knew. With the fire alarm blaring, none of the staff had been close enough to hear. Detectives would piece it together eventually, how long the attack had lasted, and how long Eric and Dylan had killed. Those would turn out to be very different answers. Something peculiar had transpired 17 minutes into the attack. The investigation outpaced the SWAT teams. Detectives were combing the park, the library, Leawood Elementary, and the surrounding community. They interviewed hundreds of students and staff, everyone they could find. When waves of fresh survivors outnumbered police officers, they conducted 30 to 60 second triage interviews. Who are you? Where were you? What did you see? Friends of the killers and witnesses to bloodshed were identified quickly, and detectives were waved over for lengthier interviews. Lead investigator Kate Batten performed some interviews personally. She was briefed on the rest. Batten was intent on getting every detail right and avoiding costly errors that might come back to haunt them later. Everyone learned a lot from hearing about the O.J. Simpson case and JonBenet Ramsey, she said later. We didn't need another situation like those. Her team also ran a simple search on Jeffco computer files and found something stunning. The shooters were already in the system. Eric and Dylan had been arrested junior year. They got caught breaking into a van to steal electronic equipment. They had entered a 12-month juvenile diversion program, performing community service and attending counseling. They'd completed the program with glowing reviews exactly 10 weeks before the massacre. More disturbing was a complaint filed 13 months earlier by Randy and Judy Brown, the parents of the shooter's friend, Brooks. Eric had made death threats toward Brooks. 10 pages of murderous rants printed from his website had been compiled. Someone in Batten's department had known about this kid. Batten organized the information and composed a single-spaced, 6-page search warrant for Eric's home and a duplicate for Dylan's. She dictated them over the phone. The warrants were typed up in Golden, the county seat, delivered to a judge, signed, driven out to the killer's homes, and exercised within 4 hours of the first shots, before the SWAT team reached the library and discovered the attack was over. The warrants cited 7 witnesses who'd identified Harris and or Klebold as the gunman. Agent Fuselier heard about the bodies on the police radio at 3:20. He had just gotten word that his son Brian was okay. Mass murder meant a massive investigation. "How can I help?" Fuselier asked the Jeffco commanders. "Do you want federal agents?" "Definitely," they said. Jeffco had a small detective team. There was no way it could handle the task. An hour later, 18 evidence specialists began arriving. A dozen special agents would follow, along with half a dozen support staff. At 4 p.m., Jeffco went public about the fatalities. Chief spokesman Steve Davis called a press conference in Clement Park, with Sheriff Stone by his side. The pair had been briefing reporters all afternoon. Most of the press had never heard of either man, but consensus about them emerged quickly. Sheriff Stone was a straight shooter. He had a deep, gruff voice and classic Western mentality. No hedging, no bluster, no bullshit. What a contrast to the blow-dried spokesman affixed to his side. Steve Davis began the conference by reiterating warnings about rumors. Above all, he stressed caution on 2 subjects, the number of fatalities and the status of the suspects. Davis opened the floor to questions. The first was directed to him by name. Sheriff Stone stepped forward, brushing Davis and his cautions aside. He held custody of the microphone through most of the press conference. The sheriff answered nearly every question directly, despite later evidence that he had little or no information on many of them. He winged it. The death count nearly doubled. "I've heard numbers as high as 25, he said. He pronounced the killers unequivocally dead. He fed the myth of a third shooter. 3 dead suspects in the library, he said. "Well, where is the third?" "We're not sure if there is a third yet or not, or how many. The SWAT operation is still going on in there." Stone repeated the erroneous death count several times. It led newscasts around the world. Newspaper headlines proclaimed it the next morning, 25 dead in Colorado. Stone said the 3 kids detained in the park appeared to be associates of these gentlemen or good friends. He was wrong. They had never met the killers and were soon cleared. Stone made the first of an infamous string of accusations. "What are these parents doing that are letting their kids have automatic weapons?" he asked. Reporters were surprised to hear the rumors about automatic weapons confirmed. They rushed in with follow-ups. "I don't know anything about the weapons," Stone admitted. "I assume there were probably automatic weapons just because of the mass casualties." A reporter asked about motive. "Craziness," Stone said. Wrong again. By now, dozens of kids had fled the school with their friends. School officials herded them across Clement Park to meet school buses that would drive past police barricades to Leawood. The buses parked directly beside the site of the press conferences. The kids trudged meekly toward the media throng. Many sobbed quietly. Others helped distraught students along, holding their hands or slinging an arm over their shoulders. Most of the kids stared at the ground. The crowd of reporters parted. These were not the faces of interview subjects. But the students were eager to speak. Teachers hurried the kids, chiding them to keep quiet. They were having none of that. The bus windows started coming down, heads popped out, and kids recounted their ordeals. Kids piled off the buses. The teachers tried to coax them back on. Not a chance. A tough-looking senior described his terror in the choir room with a sense of bravado and chivalry. But his voice cracked when a reporter asked how he felt. "Horrible," he said. "There were two kids lying on the pavement. I started crying. I haven't cried for years. I don't know what I'm going to do." Attention focused on the students. Endless reunions with their parents played out on TV. A different group weathered the crisis in seclusion. More than 100 teachers worked at Columbine, along with dozens of support staff. 150 families feared for their husbands, wives, and parents. There was no rendezvous point where they could gather. Most drove home and waited by their phones. That's where Linda Lou Sanders kept vigil. She had celebrated her mom's 70th birthday with the family. Then they'd headed up into the mountains for a pleasure drive. On the way, Linda's brother-in-law called her sister Melody on her cell. "Where does Dave teach?" "Columbine." "You better head back down there." Everyone gathered at Linda's house. Most of the news was good. Only one adult was reported injured, and it was a science teacher, which ruled out Dave. So why hadn't he called? Those reports were nearly accurate. Only one adult had been hit, and Dave was still bleeding at that moment. The sense that afternoon was that gunfire had erupted all over the place. In fact, it had mostly been limited to the library and the west steps outside. Teachers had not been studying for tests or strolling outside to enjoy their lunch in the sunshine. If the bombs had gone off as planned, it would have wiped out a quarter of the faculty in the teachers' lounge. But they had been spared by dumb luck, all but one. Dave held on for hours in Science Room 3. Then the kids and teachers were evacuated, and none knew whether he'd made it. It would be a few days before the family would fully understand what had transpired in that room. It would take years to resolve why he'd lain there for over 3 hours, and who was to blame. All Dave's family knew was that he had failed to call. He must be trapped inside the building, they thought. That wasn't good. Linda hoped he wasn't a hostage. She assumed he was hiding. He would be safe. He was not a risk taker. The family monitored the TV and took turns answering calls. The phone rang incessantly, but it was never Dave. Linda called his business line repeatedly. Nobody picked up. Linda was an athletic woman in her late 40s, but she had a fragile psyche. Her smile was warm, but tentative, as if she could shatter from a harsh word or gesture. Dave had found great satisfaction in protecting her. In his absence, her daughters and sisters stepped in. Every call was fraught, so her family made sure to screen. In mid-afternoon, she got the urge to answer a call herself. "It was a woman," she said later, "and she said she was from the Denver Post and my husband had been shot. Do I have a comment?" I screamed. I threw the phone. I have no idea what happened from then on. Robin Anderson was scared. Her prom date was a mass murderer. She had apparently armed him. To her knowledge, only three people had known about the gun deal, and the other two were dead. Had they told anyone? Were guns traceable? She had not signed anything. Would the cops know? Should she keep her mouth shut? The cops did not know. Robin had been debriefed in Clement Park and had played it totally cool. She told the detective where she had been and what she had seen. She told the truth, but not the whole truth. She didn't know for sure who had been shooting, so she didn't mention that she knew them. She certainly didn't mention the guns. Should she? The guilt began eating her up. Robin talked to Zach Heckler on the phone that afternoon. She kept her mouth shut about the weapons. He didn't. He was clueless about the guns, thank God. But he knew the guys had been making pipe bombs. Bombs? Really? That astounded Robin. Yes, really, Zach said. And he wasn't surprised at all. Zach didn't have quite the innocent picture of Dylan that Robin did. It sounded just like those guys to run down the halls laughing while they killed people, he said. Zach did not tell Robin that he helped Eric and Dylan make any pipe bombs. She wondered, did he? Was he mixed up in this? More than her? Zach was scared, too. They all were. Anybody close to the killers. Zach wasn't volunteering information to the cops. He'd omitted mentioning the pipe bombs during his debriefing. Chris Morris went the opposite route. He'd call the cops in the first hour, as soon as he suspected that his friends were involved. He was handcuffed in Clement Park and spirited away on national television. He kept talking at the police station. He described Eric's interest in Nazis, a crack about jocks, and some scary recent suggestions, cutting power to the school and setting PVC bombs at the exits with screws for shrapnel. If Chris's story was legit, it suggested the killers had been leaking information about their plans, a classic characteristic of young assailants. If Eric and Dylan had leaked to Chris, chances were they had tipped off others as well. Chris's dad was called. He contacted a lawyer. At 7:43 p.m., the three sat down with detectives for a formal interview. Chris and his father signed a form waiving their rights. The cops found Chris highly cooperative. He described the killer's obsessions with explosives and volunteered all sorts of details. Dylan had brought a pipe bomb to work once, but Chris ordered him to get it out of there. Chris knew the guys had gotten their hands on guns. It had been an open secret around Blackjack several months ago that Eric and Dylan were looking for hardware. They'd never told Chris directly, but he had heard it from several people. Chris had a hunch who had come through for them, a kid named Phil Duran. Duran used to work at Blackjack, then moved to Chicago for a high-tech job. Before he'd left, Duran told Chris he had gone shooting with Eric and Dylan. Something about bowling pins and maybe an AK-47. Duran never said he had bought the guns, but Chris figured it was him. It sounded staggering how much Chris had known. He swore he had not taken it seriously. He agreed to turn over the clothes he was wearing and allow detectives to search his room. Everyone agreed to rendezvous at his house. Chris's mom met the cops at the front door, handed them his PC, and showed them upstairs. Then his brother arrived with Chris's clothes in a paper bag. He said Chris was afraid to come home. Mobs of media were already staking out the street. The cops found nothing of obvious value, but gathered up piles of material. They left at 11:15. Robin needed company. She couldn't handle the stress alone. Her best friend Kelly came over around 7:30 on Tuesday evening. They went to Robin's room. Kelly knew the boys well, too, especially Dylan. She had been part of the prom group. There was something Kelly didn't know, Robin told her. Remember that favor she had done Eric and Dylan last November? Kelly remembered. It had been a big secret. Robin had told Kelly repeatedly about this big favor she had done the guys, but she never would divulge what it was. Now she had to tell someone. It had been a gun show, the Tanner gun show in Denver. Eric and Dylan had called her on a Sunday, if she remembered right. They had checked the show out on Saturday, seen these sweet-looking shotguns, but they'd gotten carded. They were both underage then. They needed an 18-year-old with them. Robin was 18. She really liked Dylan, so she went. It was their money. Robin made sure not to sign any papers, but she was the one who bought the three guns. The boys each got a shotgun. One had some kind of pump thing on it. Eric went for a rifle, too, a semi-automatic that looked like a giant paintball gun. Robin felt so guilty, Kelly said later. How could she have imagined this? Robin didn't tell Kelly everything. She came clean with the main secret, but held back on a detail. She told Kelly she didn't know it was Eric and Dylan killing people until she heard it announced on TV that night. Kelly didn't buy it. Robin had never received a B in high school. She could have put that mystery together. When she heard about the trench coats, she had to have known. The Klebolds spent the afternoon and evening on their porch, waiting. They were no longer allowed inside. At 8:10 p.m., a deputy arrived with instructions. Their home was now a crime scene. They had to go. Tom and Sue Klebold told friends they felt hit by a hurricane. Hurricanes don't hit the Rockies. They'd never seen it coming. We ran for our lives, Sue said later. We didn't know what had happened. We couldn't grieve for our child. Officers escorted Tom in to gather clothes for the next couple of days. Then Sue went in to take care of the pets. She fetched two cats, two birds, and their food bowls and litter boxes. At 9 p.m., they drove away. They talked to a lawyer that night. He related a sobering thought. Dylan isn't here anymore for people to hate, he said. So people are going to hate you.